And let me tell you, no matter how bad it appears to get, I promise you one thing, we're going to be here for you. Unless an asteroid takes me out or something like that. But other than that, we're going to be here day in and day out going through these stories that affect you all the time. And one story that has been on our minds for years now, HAARP. What the heck are they doing with this device? Well, Dr. Nick Begich will join us in a moment and shed some light on this on Coast to Coast AM. Well, most of you know him, but if you're brand new to the show, here he is, Dr. Nick Begich, well known for his work and research on HAARP, mind effects, and so much more. He has widely reported in these areas as an expert for many publications and government organizations and private companies as well. Here he is back on Coast to Coast, Dr. Nick Begich. Hey, my friend, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing very well, and it's been a while, and as always, it's so good to be with you again, George.
Times continue to change, Nick, don't they? My gosh.
Yeah, you know, I unfortunately have a pathology. I'm a pathological optimist, so I still see through all this. There is some bright linings on the other side.
I am too. You know, I see life as a roller coaster. You've got highs and lows. The secret is you hold on, because eventually that thing's going to come to a stop.
Well, you know, I think the one thing we can depend on is change, for sure. And I think the changes everyone's experiencing, you know, are in some levels traumatic, other levels maybe transforming is maybe a better word. Because I think that's the sign of the times these days. And I think there's you know, in all of that comes a lot of disruption, and I think that's what everyone feels and sees, and old systems kind of fall away, and new thought comes into being. And I think we're at that point in humanity for a lot of reasons. You know, and I think there's maybe a time of reckoning where we're sort of reevaluating what we're doing as human beings with our science and our technology and our world and our environment, and most of all, one another. And I think that's from my perspective, the optimistic side of this is that in the suffering also comes perhaps an awakening.
That's true. Hey, give us some inside information, Nick. Your brother Mark, senator from Alaska.
Right.
He's a Democrat. Your family's been a Democrat. Your father was a congressman.
Right.
God rest his soul. And right. Your brother's been in office now, what, a couple of years, I think? A
couple of years, yeah. And he's moved really rapidly. I mean, he's the fifth-ranking Democrat in the Senate after being there just 2 years, and that's pretty impressive, and it speaks well of Mark in terms of ability to work, you know, work in that environment right now, because it is a challenge. I saw Mark on Thursday at his father-in-law's funeral delivery.
Oh, no.
But, you know, in that, I got to say this about my brother is, you know, in that setting, you know, my brother's humanity showed in a way that is so refreshing to see in an elected public servant at that level.
Nick, it's genetic. It's in your family.
Well, I can tell you, you know, even seeing it in my brother, it is a good thing, because I can tell you he is a person of heart and compassion. And the kind of person that belongs in public life. And although people disagree with a lot of things he does, like, you know, politicians have to endure, because no one ever comes to you. They always come at you in that role. But it is a challenge. And the sign of the times is a huge challenge. And my sense of it is, and I think a lot of us sense that, is, you know, this underlying dis-ease that either gets resolved in a rational, practical way under the current, you know, leadership, or new leadership's going to come in. And I think that's, I mean, what we're all seeing happening in Washington is...
It's frustrating, isn't it?
It is. And I think it is, and I know it is for everyone there, and it is for lots of reasons. But when you look at what's happened is it's been removed from us. Our republic's been removed from the average person. The accessibility of government, whether it be the courts, I mean, think about it. If you're in the court system and you're in there at all, you better be rich to have any measure of justice. I don't care what the situation is.
That's right. Hey, now, has your brother pulled you aside during this situation that we've been in lately and simply said, Nick, oh, my God.
you know, I mean, maybe not in that way, but certainly, you know, it is. It's a mess. And it's one that there is no simple solutions. Now, you know, thinking forward, and I think that's something that Americans need to do, you know, and again, I'm optimistic, Alaska, and Mark's knowledge of Alaska is going to be helpful in this, because Alaska represents 20% of the landmass of the United States, more or less. We have a coastline, which means federal coastal waters that go out 200 miles, larger than the East Coast, West Coast, and Gulf Coast combined. And we have a huge, huge base of natural resource here that represents a national wealth, the national wealth that many people forget about. And that national wealth has the possibility, really, if you look at it and real hard dollars and cents of turning this thing around. I mean, just natural gas and oil.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
Alone, bail out the the entire national debt, at least in the current column. You know, $14 trillion more or less. And you know, the idea that we have these resources and we're not really considering, you know, sort of what do we do with those and how do we do this, and maybe the formula. And I've said this for years and advocated this for years. The formula we have with the globalists, the global oil industry. In Alaska, is it should be criminal, because the amount of resource that leaves and the risks that are taken versus the rewards to the public are disproportional. It's not a balanced deck anymore. And this is where 88% of the oil-producing countries of the world produce their own, you know, and they contract with the oil industry, the private industry, to do the developmental work and the drilling and all those things the private industry does well, but they keep ownership of that basic natural resource for the benefit of their populations. In the case of Norway, they established a permanent fund that now is over $400 billion. Alaska's permanent fund is over $40 billion from its share of revenues. And, you know, we run basically a state on the endowment principle here. We don't have a state income tax or a state sales tax or a state property tax, because the resource base pays for the cost.
Pays for that, yeah.
Yeah. And the national plan, you know, when you look at the balance sheet, we probably have those possibilities as well, but we need a broader way of thinking, one that kind of breaks down those powers that be that really influence the republic. I mean, when you go to D.C. now, it is a massive lobbyist, and if you want something done, you better have $500,000 to dish out to a lobbyist and be able to maintain a communication campaign to 535 legislators pretty incessantly to get anything done.
Yeah.
And that is not the way to run government.
Not at all. Not at all. When you think about Alaska, when we bought Alaska from Russia back, I think it was in 1867, we bought it for $7 million, right?
Right. It was a hell of a deal.
What a deal.
A really
good
deal.
That's the last time we ever made a deal.
You know, and it was kind of an extortion. You know, they figured we'd take it anyway. But you know what the heck? We did buy it, you know, at least on some principles. But there are some debates about that now. I can tell you from the indigenous perspective here in Alaska, there's a lot of debate about what we actually bought. And that's a story for maybe another day. But, the thing about Alaska is we are such a new state. I mean, 1959. You know, when you think about what's really known here, the road system, all the roads in Alaska are 15,000 miles. You know, most big cities, big metropolitan, New York has more, probably Manhattan.
Sure.
You know, so when you start to think about accessibility, and that's been the big challenge for Alaska's resource development, but when you look at the resource base here, things are pretty, you always have the environmental concerns that need to be balanced against development, but Alaska holds a treasury of literally trillions and trillions of dollars in natural resources. And when you start to think about, you know, how do we solve the problem in the long run? Well, it's going to be based on some kind of production coming out of the country, and producing and adding value to our natural resources was the way the country was originally built. And the demand for those natural resources and value-added components, with 6 billion people trying to catch up with the first world, offers tremendous opportunity in the undeveloped portions of the United States. And Alaska, believe me, is undeveloped. Over 30% of our rural villages still don't have running water and sewer systems.
Do you see some of these states in our country, because of the economic situation, seceding and trying to form their own little country?
Well, you know, Alaska, you know, we had, I was actually a member for a long while of the Alaska Independent Party, and it was founded on that premise. And my position in it was just some equal footing in the honoring of the Statehood Act, because what happened here in the Statehood Act, which was the law that created this state, several things happened that were incorrect. But the biggest issue was we didn't have the vote here of statehood, yes or no, remain a territory, become a commonwealth, or independence, which was actually what the United States had agreed to under the UN Charter that we had signed some time before. All the territories that were held by the the various countries were given those opportunities. And in the case of the South Pacific, most of those colonies went away in Africa and all over the world. But in the case of Alaska and Hawaii, there was a little different arrangement. Yeah. And so some people still take exception to that in the way it was handled. And for indigenous people here, there was a lot of unresolved issues that to this day continue to create aggravation. And I've worked in that world as a tribal administrator here, as a tribal liaison, and worked with tribal people, as did my my father before me. And those problems, you know, I know Mark is still, you know, now he gets to do it. He gets to try and solve some of that. But in the context of national land policy, because that's what all these issues started as, which were all resource policies. And then the multinationals came in and really hijacked Alaska state government. And that kind of got unraveled a few years back and seems to be working much better now. But still, the influence is pretty severe. And on the national level, the disappointment there is it's all about lobbyists. And that's where we need to seize the republic. We need to get those guys out of there and start building public policy that actually might make sense. And we're a long way from that at the moment.
We sure are. So somewhere up in Alaska, there's this array called HAARP.
Right.
What is it?
All right. This is, you know, and we've done this for quite a while, but HAARP is a high-frequency active auroral research project, which was originally an Air Force and Navy project, and then later in 2003 got turned over to DARPA, which does predominantly, you know, military research. And essentially, HAARP is an array or field of radio frequency antennas. They're about 72 feet tall. They have a cross dipole about 60 feet going the opposite direction as the mass holding it up. And these are 180 in the field. And by firing the radio frequency energy through these in a very specific way, you can create a number of effects. But the primary effect is to concentrate or focus that radio frequency energy so that when it hits various areas of the upper above the atmosphere and the upper layers above us, going out maybe 30 miles plus, what they can do is concentrate radio frequency energy and then cause it to couple with the components of our natural environment and essentially affect them, almost like plugging into the electrical system of the Earth, in this case the ionosphere, which begins about 30 miles above the Earth's surface. And well, then by oscillating or modulating the signal, then you can create a number of effects.
And a lot of people have thought, this thing is manipulating the weather. What do you think?
Well, you know, here's what I do know about that is when Dr. Eastland, who was the inventor of HAARP, first developed it, he had a theory, a couple theories of weather modification. And one of them was essentially that these instruments could create a heating effect about 30 miles above the Earth's surface. And then what they would do is you get about a 30-mile diameter sphere formed that would actually push out, so it'd get like a column. And when it would push that energy out, it would heat the ionosphere, push it out further into space, and as a consequence, you get a lower atmosphere moving into that space. And so if you have jet streams moving in the area, you could use this for altering jet streams. That same column of atmosphere that ended up moving into a place where it shouldn't be, say it hit a low-orbiting satellite as an example, it could actually be used as a way to knock out a low-orbiting satellite, create friction and knock that out, or an incoming asteroid, for that matter. As you said going into the show, you know, they have only so much space before they burn up in atmosphere.
That's right.
Or hit the Earth. But imagine now if you could project the trajectory, and this is one of the things Russian scientists suggested about HAARP and instruments like HAARP, you could then push the atmosphere out, and instead of having 30 miles, maybe have 200 miles. So, you know, seven times the distance or larger objects being able to be broken up and burned up before they ever hit the Earth. So that, you know, sort of some combination of things there in terms of weather modification and then a couple other applications that other researchers pointed out along the way. And the other area of weather modification, and this came just the year before Ben Eastland passed away, he attended a conference that I had arranged and was hosted by the Lay Institute when I was their executive director in Dallas. And he brought up this weather modification issue, and he had done some new research that he actually had delivered at the University of Pennsylvania and showing that with 1,600 times less energy than he originally thought was needed for some real serious kinds of weather modification. This could be done with HAARP by manipulating what he said were gravitational waves that he saw as the root for many kinds of weather systems. And so, you know, when Eastland really started looking at what HAARP was, you know, by being able to modulate a frequency across a huge carrier, the ionosphere, you could do all kinds of things in terms of what you wanted to affect. And so when you start looking at weather applications and gravity waves as very long wavelengths, and then going into ELF wavelengths, which then have the ability to penetrate the Earth and sea for communications purposes with submarines, and also for ground imaging, and also, interestingly enough, and this is always one of those other controversial areas, ELFs are correlate with predominant brainwave activity in humans. So there's a frequency following effect that somewhere tonight we'll probably get into. But that, you know, those kinds of things, when you think about big systems like HAARP affecting the ionosphere or coupling, joining with this electrical component that surrounds the Earth, and then treating it like a component where it can modulate it, it can change its character. And that's really what HAARP was all about from the beginning, was sort of learning a way to manipulate. Now, why would we want to do that? The one of the big reasons was, you know, during solar activity, like we experience from time to time, that knocks out communication systems.
That's right.
And so their thought was, well, heck, if we can figure out a way to stabilize it sort of from the bottom up, you know, we could maintain our communications during those times. Or perhaps do other things to disturb communications while carrying our own signals in the case of warfare. And by modulating certain signals, you could actually disrupt the whole system, but at the same time, sort of piggyback your own signal. So you'd be communicating with, say, your troops while everybody else's communications are completely knocked down. But those kinds of applications on a global sort of scale is what HAARP is, and many of the new technologies are sort of approaching things on that sort of scale.
Is it secretive, Nick, the things that they do there?
A lot of it is these days. I mean, they don't, and a lot of it isn't. I mean, we've been able to find most everything that we found was unclassified. The only odd document, and it wasn't classified, but it was considered a technical memorandum. And these are supposedly exempt from the Freedom of Information Act, and they can deny their existence and a lot of other things. But this particular memorandum, and, you know, I worked government a long time, family for a couple generations, and memorandums, you know, in our office correspondence, and when they get over 600 pages, you know, I look at that as a published book, you know what I mean? I mean, it's two volumes thick, and we got hold of one of these on HAARP in the very early stages of our research, and it really laid out sort of the long-term plans on the program, and it was a compilation of papers presented by the experts from all over the world that the government had brought together and hosted, really to take a look at the sort of pre-planning effort before the engineering designs were finalized and HAARP was put into construction.
Well, that's amazing stuff. What's the latest with you, Dick? What are you doing these days?
Well, actually, I'm doing a number of finished just doing a number of projects for Tyonic Native Corporation and the Native Village of Tyonic, and I was working with them for about 2.5 years. And you know my wife, Sheila. Of course, you've met her.
Yeah,
Sheila
yeah.
and I have separated, so that's a big change in my life.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, you know, things do complete, I think.
Amicable, I trust.
Yeah.
Hey, Nick, hold on. I want to come back and talk with you about that. We'll be right back. Well, for you Coast Insiders, we've got our video chat on Tuesday at 8 p.m. Pacific time, so come on by the room. It fills up awfully fast. You know, when I'm in L.A., we do the video chat on the second Tuesday of every month. It lasts about 30 minutes. You fire away your questions, and I talk about it on camera. So lots of folks have been joining that. If you want to be a Coast Insider, you simply go to coasttocoastam.com, where you can sign up for less than 25 cents a day. And welcome back with Nick Beckett. So, Nick, you're putting your personal life in order here.
Yeah, I am. And actually, it's you know, been in transition since last November. And so it's been a real period of introspection for me, for sure, and sort of a rethinking of my life going forward. I'm 52 this year. And, you know, thinking about the things I've been doing the last 16 years and sort of really recognizing the components of that I think need to go forward. And it certainly has changed. My view of my work going forward certainly has changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sure does, and I hope you keep doing what you're doing.
Oh, yeah, I indeed will. In fact, I'm quite excited about it in this sense. From my perspective, we talk a lot about technologies, and over the years, we've had this great dialogue to get sort of a sense of what's out there. We've covered the HARP issue, and we've covered the mind effects issue, which is always really controversial. But, coming from all that background and thinking about all that in terms of human potentials, this is the big observation for me and all that as it relates to technology is, we always try and duplicate what nature does. It's kind of our predisposition as created and creative creatures, in my view. And so we're out there, we're sort of doing all this stuff. But at the same time, as we do it, we sort of change our own belief systems about it, if you think about it.
Sure.
And so as a consequence, we sort of recognize our own potentials in the course of developing technologies that reflect them. And this is where, when I think about some of the people I've met all over the world, and in that closed mind effects conference, one of the big issues that came up was, and it surprised the heck out of me, but virtually everyone in that room had this belief or some version of it, that the next evolution of humankind were to these higher potentials or these higher capabilities. The things that a man is sort of chasing after right now technologically, and at the same time, when you think about the problems the world faces today, the solution lies in fully actualized potential that resides in every human being. I mean, really, if you think about what's possible and not what's so much impossible, humans rise to an incredible level when you put the being part back sort of in it and taking control of sort of what's in front of us. And so much of the simplest of things removes our power so rapidly, and it's the fear and the worry. And we've talked about, in past programs, I know, about the effect of that when you look at, say, an EEG and you look at what people's going on in people's brains during fear and worry. And it's incoherent brain patterns. It's all the kinds of things connected with really bad decision-making, as it generally goes. And so, how do you stop that noise? Because that's what it really is. It interferes with our ability to reach the kinds of states of consciousness that lend themselves to creative work, to learning, to the things that solve the problems that we're in the middle of. And that's, when you really think about it, on a technological basis, there's even some things to help you do that. The thing is, the society has moved to the pharmaceutical model of calming the mind, which is not a good model. Better to learn how to do it ourselves and modulate our activity in a way that is, we're more in the driver's seat, if you will. And that's where I think the technology and what fascinates me going forward in terms of my work and the things I'm really interested in moving into the public with is this idea that maybe some technologies can be a bridge to our own recognition of our own possibilities. Right. And in that, we solve our problems.
Sometimes it's good.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's good. Now, with HARP,
yeah,
because yes, there are some mind effects involved here.
Right.
Do you think they were done on purpose, or this is something they stumbled into after the fact?
Oh, I don't know whether before or after, but they certainly know what they have.
They do.
In terms,
okay.
Because this happened way back. If you go back to the 60s, they knew that if you could modulate the ionosphere, you could have this kind of effect of entrainment or FFR, frequency following response. And I get into that dialogue in the mind control book we did, which kind of lays out what happens. What happens is this external signal couples with the brain in such a way that it begins to mirror the external signal, reflect it more or less, just duplicate it. And as a consequence, it's driven, so it changes your emotional state. And you can do this with any electromagnetic carrier of a variety of kinds. And there was a quote that came out of, an article called The Mind Has No Firewall. It goes back to the U.S. Army War College in the late 90s. And they talked about all the different ways you could do this, and you could do it through the internet, the power grid, radio frequency broadcast, by just modulating a signal And even Persinger talked about this at Laurentian University in one of his papers, and it was the idea that you could modulate a signal that would just cause this emotional shift. You know, and then you could maybe just feed a normal news broadcast, as a simple example, indicting some ethnic group or some population as the cause of your ills, and a certain amount of that anxiety or dis-ease would be redirected in that direction. But these are very simple ways, and with being able to modulate the ionosphere, it goes back to the idea of J.F. Gordon McDonald at UCLA, and he was a science advisor to Johnson in the late 60s. And in 69, he wrote a chapter in a book called Unless Peace Comes. And in that chapter, he talked about sort of this idea of, again, stroking the ionosphere in just the right way. They just didn't have the technology in the 60s. HARP gave him a technology that could accomplish that, could modulate within a very broad bandwidth from ultra-low to visible light, depending on how they utilize the primary signal to create secondary reactions in the atmosphere and ionosphere. And what comes of that is the ability then, when you think about everything that's constructed out of inorganic or organic matter, virtually everything that's matter, you know, when you think about being able to resonate or modulate a signal into that material, that'll do certain things. It'll cause it to do certain things. And here's the thing about that when you start looking at the human body. You can manipulate any of the organs. You can manipulate any of the cell structures, any of the chemicals or chemical compounds by modulating energy in a very precise way, like dialing in a radio station like people did tonight to get a nice clear signal. You can dial in a component of the body and cause chemical reactions or energy exchanges that drive chemical reactions fundamentally at a really base level. And you can do this accidentally by just what we do in our environment.
Every day. Yeah.
Fields, right? And we do that every day, actually. We are doing that. And we can also avoid it by understanding the physiological link between these energy exchanges and these structures within living organisms and then their effects on our chemistry and these outcomes. And that's where I think the science, when you go looking forward, that's where we're going. And I'm pretty excited about that because therein lies a number of things, not just in terms of physical health, but in terms of what happens when you start to elevate your potentials as a human being. And what happens in that sense is you start to see very complex problems get resolved in elegant ways. And I think that's what is sort of missing in a lot of the dialogue. We're so worried, we're so hung up on the worrying part of what's happening around us, we're failing to see our way through it. And that's, in science and technology offers part of that, but the real part of that is human beings engaging themselves again and recognizing that in garages is where airplanes get invented.
Yeah, and computers.
Yeah, exactly. All the things that we really think are so cool, everyone else thought were impossible, except for somebody in a garage somewhere. And there's a lot of real underutilized talent out there right now in terms of the work pool. You know, think about all the people that aren't working. I mean, but we need to refocus some energy. You know, I mean, if you're not working, man, get involved in a political campaign and start unelecting some people and get
That's
some
right.
people in there. Or get involved in your community in some way that starts to take some of your power back as an individual and start insisting on it as an individual in the appropriate way. And really, when I look forward in my own transition in these months, and I look at sort of what I look forward to, I look forward to really the opportunity that is offered when people start to actualize. And I see a lot of people around me doing just that. And that's a real beautiful thing to see. And I think that's a place that all of us can play a role. And it's in that effort that ultimately and fundamentally governments change, corporations change, and things change. People change.
Nick, the push for this mind control or effect.
Yep.
How are they trying to enhance the human mind, or are they trying to literally control the human mind?
Well, this is interesting because both kind of come into play. You know, on the one hand, the control factor, you know, when you start to look at the weaponized approaches to mind control, that is always an issue. You know, sort of to shut down your adversaries' ability to think clearly, because then they can't operate whatever great machines they might have. And the other is to enhance your own troops' intellect. So, I mean, things like increasing your own troops' anomalous human capacities, or what we used to call extrasensory perceptions, has been part of the military model going back to the 60s. Because the idea of having your troops guess right, you know, that matters in battle.
Yeah.
So these are really important things. And so there's a lot of money has been spent in what used to be called paraphysics or extrasensory perception areas that of research. And this whole area opened up sort of this other thing from a military perspective. This is a discovery of what those anomalous capabilities were. And really, I think that scared the hell out of them. Because when you start to think about every one of us have the capability, and wouldn't that be dangerous from a control perspective?
Sure would.
You know, if people actually actually operated in the way that we can. And so I think there's two edges to this. One is sort of how do you suppress it from the general population and your adversaries, and then how do you enhance it in your own troops? So both end up being part of that equation, and it shows up through the literature and in the book Controlling the Human Mind, when we sort of analyze the history on it. And then on the you know, on the other side, on the private side, there's a lot of interest in sort of the energetic effect of various kinds of energy exchanges physiologically. And so you've got military sort of figuring it out on how to develop the best control and kill systems, and private side going, wow, you know, there's some real good opportunity here in the healing arts that become very, very compelling. Things that don't make sense. I mean, there was for speeding up, you know, tissue regeneration using various elements of energy, whether it be modulated light or sound or other combinations. You know, and there's things that start to document in the research that start to say, well, there's more to this than we understand. And the fork in the road was essentially those that went towards the chemistry and those that went towards the math and science and physics. And underlying all those chemical reactions are energetic exchanges that fundamentally drive them. And so energy exchanges become very important when you start to look at chemistry within living organisms.
What happens if something goes awry, if they're trying to control or manipulate a mind?
Well, here's the thing. It's always gone awry, because anyone that feels they have the right to step into the consciousness of another is the grossest of violations.
Right.
If from my perspective, you know, this is something that every religious tradition speaks to in terms of free will, and that is the fundamental. Even God doesn't want to interfere with that, according to most traditions. And so that whole concept to me is repugnant as a concept, that even government would pursue that research in this line. I mean,
But they do.
Yeah, they absolutely do. In fact, there's contracts. The last one I saw expired. It was out for bid till 1909, and it was looking for new ways to do this. And the big article that was driving some of this came out in Technology Horizons, which is by the Electromagnetic Directorate of the Air Force, had an article in there. And it was essentially on this whole concept in June of 2004 called controlled effects, which were about hardware control and software, overriding software within computers. And then the third component was overriding the human operator. And so ways are being devised to override all five senses, touch, taste, smell, you know, sight, sound, in such a way as to create what they're describing as holographic experience that can't distinguish the real from the synthesized, being able to create enough brain modeling to create the effects of electronic telepathy. There's two contracts, University of California, that are dealing with that right now. So, I mean, there's this whole idea of what has been learned is enough to know that it's only a matter of signal generation and signal interpretation to create that reality, which, you know, explains why some people actually have demonstrated that reality, because they know how to do that. Somehow they have that wiring. Maybe we all have it, and that's the suggestion that a lot of people would make, and it's our belief systems that suspend our ability to access those aspects of our higher consciousness, and our conscious, our unconscious level of fear and worry that keeps us, unfortunately, from reaching those places where it's even possible to have those experiences, which is a slower pulse rate of the brain. And this is where the mind control issue comes into play, because there's, when you think about it, in your deepest states of sleep, you're in this delta state, 1 to 4 hertz or pulses per second, and then theta is sort of that dreamlike state between around 4 pulses and 7 pulses per second, and then up to the alpha, this focused zone kind of place in the waking state, and then above that, the beta, where we are, if I haven't put someone to sleep out there. But the idea is you modulate a signal in, and you can then, again, entrain the brain, so you can get maybe into this ideal state. In fact, there's a lot of ways to do that. On the other hand, you can create a situation where you just create disruption. And unfortunately, most of us, if you think about mind, how does mind control work the easiest? Well, you're fatigued when you come home from work. You go and sit in front of a television set, most people do. The modulation of the television set actually
hypnotizes you.
Almost. Hypnotizes you. So your wife is hollering at you, your husband's hollering at you. You don't even hear them.
You tune them out, yeah.
You're in a trance. You're in a slight trance being programmed by the TV. You're not watching the program. You are the program and when you fall into that state. That's what's happening. I mean, that's what happens. So when you think about how society gets shaped into fear and worry, I mean, think about the feed you're getting at that point. I turned my news feed off for just 3 months here this summer, just to try that out. And I do the news, you know, that's my life for a long time. But I found it was very interesting because I tuned in to a newspaper a couple times a week, and that was it. And I found that most of the news, although some useful, most of it's not useful at all. It's probably more useful for people to reflect on the problems and their solutions and how they might engage them than to just get tied up on listening to the regurgitation of the bad news. And so a little bit of turning it off, I think, is a good thing every once in a while. And I know as I sort of refocused, it certainly made some sense to me. And thinking about the mind control thing again, you know, television, media, one of the things that's happened in all of that is, you know, when you're trained in psychology today, you're trained in all kinds of ways in which the brain can be affected. Like they used to do, tests on computer games. You know, they would do these tests and they'd line up a bunch of kids. They'd play the games and they'd quiz them on them, you know, to figure out what the effect was. They don't do that anymore. They do three-dimensional MRIs on the brain. They look at the brain in three dimensions.
Well, did you hear about this kid who died playing video games?
Well, this is, yeah. I can tell you what's happening is why the chemistry is so dangerous now. It should be regulated, because here's what they're doing. They look at the brain in three dimensions, see exactly which parts of the brain is firing during specific light and sound sequences. And so as a consequence, you can create very specific reactions, and the same kind of addictive reactions that you might get from heroin.
And you know what part of the brain you're going to influence.
Yeah, you're targeting it, and there's no regulation on this, and there should be, because this is a dangerous thing. And you think about what is the feed they're getting in that heightened state, and what it's also doing is the adrenals are always releasing. I mean, it just does all kinds of things physiologically, because it's designed to. And I mean, it's designed to have a physiological effect. That makes it a drug, if there ever was one. If you think about it this way. Now, what am I saying about it? Full disclosure, tell people what's going on. Let people make informed choices, and let people understand the impact of that technology.
Nick, when we come back, let's talk about electronic telepathy, how that works. And I also want to ask you about dreams. Can you get into someone else's dream to do something to them? Are they experimenting with that? Back in a moment with Nick Begich on Coast to Coast AM.